All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest on the show today is John Glazer, assistant editor at antiwar.com. How's it going, John?
Pretty good. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to have you here, and thanks for getting me all pissed off before my cup of coffee this morning.
it was intentional.
Yeah, yeah, I know how you are. Everybody wants to provoke Scott Horton. I'll tell you what, so anyway, in the email, everybody, I got this morning, this clip, is this from this morning's Morning Joe?
Yes.
From this morning's Morning Joe, the whole crew at Set Pat up there grilling, supposedly anyway, this Iranian diplomat, Larijani, and led by Richard Haass, who I forget if he's still the president of the Council on Foreign Relations or not, Colin Powell's old lickspittle from the State Department in the first Bush Jr. administration, who was supposedly a realist who left over the Iraq War and, you know, was not down with the, you know, Richard Perle set in the vice president's office. But, boy, he sounded like Benjamin Netanyahu. Like that's where he got his talking points this morning. And you know, I was a little bit distracted preparing for the show, John, but I was wondering, did you notice anything that Richard Haass said in this morning's episode of Morning Joe that contained any actual detailed accusations? Or was it all simply, as I heard, well, a bunch of member states of the UN say so?
Yeah, no evidence whatsoever. What he does is take it for granted. So what many people do, especially when they want to believe something about politics, is that they make the conclusion before being convinced or forced to that conclusion by the evidence. And the Iranian diplomat was pretty clear and pretty calm in what he said. He said that the IAEA did not prove that we're on the verge of nuclear weapons. In fact, it even admitted that that they continue to confirm the non-diversion of fissile material, which without which the Iranians cannot even be capable of starting a nuclear weapons program. And he was very calm, and the sort of I don't have another word for him, so I'll just say it. The idiots in the MSNBC crew were irate. They started provoking him and saying, you know, Iran's just a bad country and all this other stuff. It was despicable. At one point, they resorted to accusing the Iranian government of supporting terrorism around the world, biggest supporter of terrorism in the world, they said. And the Iranian diplomat came back and he said, America is the biggest supporter of terrorism in the world. And they all stopped and they said, whoa. That's absurd. That's crazy. You know, you're allowed to say that in America because we have a free country, but everyone knows that that's absurd.
Well, and that's what makes it absurd, right? The fact that he has the right to say that for a minute before being shouted down on MSNBC is proof that America does not support John Dalla and the Mujahideen-e Khalq and PJAC and Fatah al-Islam before they got eradicated by Hezbollah or whoever it was who whooped their ass, help the Israelis, arm Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And
it's a sad illustration of how even the people that are on national television are supposed to be, you know, handing down all this knowledge to the American people who watch this show. They don't even understand the most basic tenets of, for example, U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War.
Yeah, I mean, well, Mika Brzezinski, whose name is Brzezinski because she's the daughter of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is, out of all of these people, pretty damn good on Iran issues. She actually came back at one point and said to him, so you're denying that Iran has a nuclear program? Like, dude, are you even paying attention at all?
It's incredible. It's incredible. But yeah, the United States has probably the longest history that I know of a state sponsored of terrorism. I mean, if we just take right now, currently, let's think about it. The United States just waged a war against a tyrant that they used to support in support of a rebel factions of basically tribal thugs who one day after the murder, the extrajudicial execution of Muammar Gaddafi, Human Rights found 53 bodies, which had their hands tied behind their back, and they were shot in the head, all executed by these rebels who America supports. That was not the first or the last instance of widespread human rights abuses on the part of our supposed allies. They're basically just rebel factions of terrorists. Another example, we can go to Afghanistan right now. The Afghan local police are a band of, again, rebel terrorists, basically. They have committed torture, extrajudicial assassinations. They go into Afghan homes and beat people up and steal their belongings. They have been reported to have abducted one 13-year-old boy and brought him back to the commander of the Afghan local police's house and gang-raped him. Another boy, they punished for some, you know, social faux pas by hammering nails into the bottom of his feet. If there's another word for this other than terrorism, I'm not sure. You know, I think I need to go have a vocabulary lesson. But the people in MSNBC just don't understand that the American political system, especially post-World War II, is essentially all about supporting terrorist proxy forces. Yeah. We did it with the Iranian-Contras. That's a slip for you. The Contras in Nicaragua, which the United States Congress tried to prevent the executive branch from funding because they had such terrorist backgrounds and widespread human rights abuses. So the executive branch circumvented Congress in violation of the law, sold the Iranians weapons, and used the profits to continue supporting that terrorism. I mean, it's just a basic knowledge. It's a baseline of knowledge about U.S. foreign policy that nobody on national television understands. And
that's what I was thinking this morning when I was watching that was, if I'd been sitting at that table, I would have said, well, does America selling a bunch of weapons to Iran to fight the Iraqis who were also arming in the 1980s count as supporting their terrorism? Or what? You know?
Not to mention the terrorism that's going on right now. The United States currently.
MEK just blew up something this week.
MEK, but also using, in collusion with the Israelis, to assassinate nuclear scientists in Iran who have committed no crimes, present no threat to us. One of those scientists was shot in the neck outside of his child's kindergarten. These are targeted assassinations that our covert forces are engaged in inside of Iran, not to mention the cyber warfare, which the U.S. has said is terrorism, except, of course, when they engage in it with the Stuxnet virus and so on and so forth. We currently are engaged in terrorism inside Iran, and he still doesn't understand the fact that America supports terrorism.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Well, and, you know, as far as Iran's nuclear program, I think if Zbigniew Brzezinski or Pat Buchanan, who are two regulars on that show, I don't know why Pat, is Pat not a regular on that show anymore? I don't watch it anymore, but he used to always be there with Barnacle and the rest of them. And Pat, I know for a fact, because I read his article 2 days ago, could have absolutely shredded Richard Haass and this war propaganda on the spot.
Yeah, I couldn't stand Richard Haass on that show. I just couldn't stand it. That's why I had to send it to you, because I was getting irate. And I figured I'm going to push some of this this anger and frustration onto Scott so it can take some line.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot. I tell you, I was sitting here going, where's old Squinty, man? I want Pat Buchanan right now. Give me Squinty. Because he would have just thrashed him because it's in his article. You know he knows Doc Prather. And he's just channeling Doc Prather in his article. Look, what's important in this IAEA report? They don't have any fissile material. Anything they can make a bomb out of. They can't make a bomb out of. Their uranium is only enriched to 3.6%. And it's all accounted for, so forget it.
One other thing that I was consistently and naively crossing my fingers that somebody on that show would bring up in this segment was the fact that since 1979, for 40-some-odd years, the United States has been predicting that Iran is on the verge of nuclear weapons. That's reason enough to be skeptical of the current accusation.
Yeah, and anybody wants a great article on that, look at Why to Sleep in America, Nima Shirazi's blog. He's got a piece called The Phantom Menace about these Iranian nukes that are about to be invented any day now for the last 40 years, 30, 35. All right, hold it there. We'll be right back with John Glazer, everybody. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with John Glazer, assistant editor at antiwar.com. His websites are news.antiwar.com, antiwar.com/blog, and antiwar.com/donate. Once a quarter. We come to you with hat in hand asking you to help us continue existing as antiwar.com. And if you're anything like me, you'd pay your share just for the work John Glazer's doing at the blog now. If the whole damn site became just the blog, at least we'd have that, man. I'll tell you what, there ain't nothing. You can go to antiwar.com/donate, and you can find 1,000 different ways to pay. Every way that anybody ever invented for you to pay online, all of those options are available. You can sign up for a Capital One credit card where we get a cut, not out of your share, but out of their share. You can sign up for monthly donations. You can donate cars or your old house that you don't want anymore because you're upside down on it or whatever you want. No, I don't know if we'll take upside down houses. Anyway, we need your money. And so sorry for asking for money, but we need it. That's the way it goes. Antiwar.com/donate. Thank you very much for considering it. There is no billionaire named Randolph Bourne behind this thing. It's people like you who donate a little bit, a lot of you, who keep it going for us here. All right, so tell me, John, what are you reading and writing about today?
Well, I just I came across a Reuters article. I just posted this in the blog, which some Reuters reporter went into an Iraqi barbershop to ask Iraqis if America gave them democracy. And they reluctantly began to admit that, yes, we have democracy, we can vote, and we can say things in public without fear of being tortured for them. But really, I think that doesn't quite do it justice. And I think that the Iraqis are using the word democracy, but that's too loaded a word in the U.S. For that to be fairly inserted into the conversation.
Yeah, they mean it in the most minimal sense.
Precisely. Synonyms in the U.S. for the word democracy are, for example, flawless paradise or, divine heavenly providence and things like this.
Yeah, and the Fourth and the Fifth Amendments.
Yeah. The truth of it is, as the 2010 Transparency International Index put it, that out of 178 countries that they indexed for corruption, Iraq came in 175, with one being the least corrupt. It is rife with corruption. It's one of the most corrupt states on the planet. Nuri al-Maliki, the prime minister, has in numerous places circumvented parliament, consolidated illegitimate power, harshly cracked down on peaceful protests, which occurred at the outset of the Arab Spring. He's harassed and even attacked, and some people say he has killed journalists that were critical of his regime. He has been accused of torturing prisoners in secret Iraqi jails. And then I know you had talked about this in the past, but I wrote a blog post a while back based on a WikiLeaks document which had Ryan Crocker, the former U.S. envoy there, describing Maliki's turn towards centralized rule as in the U.S. interest.
Mm-hmm.
And now that the United States is leaving militarily from Iraq, we have the leadership in America talking about how we have a new normal relationship with Iraq. By normal, what they mean is that they're referring to the kind of relationship that generalizes throughout the Middle East, namely one characterized by large packages of economic and military aid to abusive governments and armies in exchange for conformity to U.S. interests. And typically this goes directly contrary to the interest of the rights of the people. And I think it's one of the biggest pities in the current state of American politics that the leadership and the media continuously refer to Iraq as a democracy that the United States bestowed upon the Iraqis. I think that's a great pity for and a sad legacy for the greatest crime of the era to have snagged.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even with the Iraqis saying, okay, yeah, sure, democracy, we can vote and all that, I don't know about the part about even we can talk freely with no fear, not if you believe, and I sure do, Bradley Manning's statement to the rat Adrian Lamo, that the reason that he finally got fed up and decided he was going to liberate all this information was because he was ordered to help the Iraqi police, you know, basically book and jail people for exactly that, you know, writing an essay, which at least in America is indistinguishable from talking in a barbershop. And it was not an essay urging the overthrow of the government or anything like that, which also would be legal here in America, at least used to be. But it was just an article questioning Maliki's corruption that you talked about, and saying, where did the money go? But anyway, when, as these, as the reporter stands there taking notes, apparently the people in the barbershop here, I guess in Baghdad, had quite a bit to say about, oh yeah, sure, we have democracy, but why don't you tell them about that?
Yeah, I should be clearer about the quotes that the Reuters report actually has, because they're certainly not pleasant. I mean, one of the guys that was reluctantly admitted that they have a democracy, he said, and I'm quoting, "But why don't you ask about the other side of the story of the U.S. presence in Iraq? Why don't you ask about their crimes, atrocities, the pain and anguish that we suffered because of the military presence here?" Another one said, "Americans brought democracy to Iraq, but our leaders undermine it. They exploit it for their own personal benefit." Another pointed to a checkpoint outside the barbershop and said, "Do you see this soldier at this checkpoint? He can do whatever he wants to me right now, and I can't say a word. Is this democracy?" One other guy said, "What democracy are you asking me about when my basic rights as a human being are being stolen? If this is what Americans mean by democracy, let it be damned," end quote. So that's actually the type of stuff that they said, so it was much harsher than I initially let on.
Yeah, well, and I like the one more, I don't know if it's the same guy talking here, put the question to the Reuters reporter, "Can you tell me who won the vote and who formed the government? Answer my question before you ask me to answer yours. Is this
right.
democracy?" And you know what? He doesn't say, I guess, at least in the part you block quoted, whether he knew the answer to that. I can guarantee you the Republicans don't know the first thing about the Iraqi National Alliance. They never heard of it. The American media, in all the time they did spend in Iraq reporting on Iraq, they never explained who was who. The only place you could go to find out who was Gareth Porter and Robert Dreyfus. Patrick Coburn. Yeah, I like that. Did he say in the rest of the piece at all whether he had an answer to who the government even was?
No. It wasn't like an op-ed. There wasn't a narrative to it.
He was
just reporting. So, no, there was no response. But actually, the other big story that I kind of would like to talk about, if it's okay, because it's on my purview, and I think it's more important than people are giving it credit. The United States yesterday, Obama announced that we would begin to station up to 2,500 U.S. Marines in Australia,
mm-hmm.
In addition to sending additional warships to peruse the ports of Australia's military bases and stuff. This is pretty important. For a long time now, the United States has been increasing its presence and influence, military influence, in Asia Pacific. And the reason is that China has been expanding militarily and economically. In the announcement, Obama said, "It's important for China to play by the rules of the road. We will send a clear message to them that we think they may need to be on track in terms of accepting the rules and responsibilities of being a world power." Now, he's right. Traditionally, the rules and responsibilities of being a world power is that countries have to make sure that they act in a way that's subservient to U.S. power. That's the rules and responsibilities of being a power on the world stage. And Obama doesn't want, he's as much of an imperialist as anyone else, despite the change in hope that we heard about. He wants to expand the military. What possible military justification do we have for placing thousands of U.S. troops in Australia?
Hey, let me ask you this. Is there a backlash, do you know, inside Australia? Because I got to figure that the people of that country who have resisted an American military presence of any substance in their country all this time anyway, even as part of the British Commonwealth, obviously they're just being made a target by this. Is there any backlash from them yet, do you know?
An op-ed that I read that was published in Australia actually did, in fact, the right wing is kind of opposed to this. They think it's intentionally an affront to China, and they're opposed.
Yeah, for kind of nationalist reasons, old right sort of reasons, huh?
Precisely, yeah. I can send it to you if you like.
Yeah, please do. It's, yeah, absolutely incredible that this is going on. It's incredible that the politicians in power there now can believe, live in a world where they can believe that they're going to get away with this. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. I don't know the strength of Australian democracy and sentiment on issues like this, and maybe the fact that Obama's a Democrat even has something to do with it, et cetera, like that. But if we live in a world where the Australian government can, after all this time, say, okay, yeah, go ahead and make us a target for some future war with China, is absolutely astonishing to me. And
but, you know, it's interesting what prompted this. What prompted it is that China has a bigger military and economy. So that's an interesting little clue into imperial grand strategy, and that's the way it's always been. Just a couple months ago, before Defense Secretary Gates retired, he was at an International Institute for Strategic Studies meeting in Singapore, and he said that, quote, sustaining a robust U.S. military presence in Asia is important for overcoming anti-access in area denial scenarios, namely when people don't want our military on their lands. He said that it's important to have military presence there in order to deter potential adversaries. And this is in line with U.S. imperial grand strategy going back to World War II. And then it was reiterated, of course, in the Bush administration's national security strategy when they said that our forces should be strong enough to dissuade potential adversaries from pursuing a military buildup in the hopes of surpassing or equaling the power of the United States.
Right, no near-peer competitors.
Hegemony.
Straight out of Paul Wolfowitz and the Project for a New American Century.
That's correct. We're just extending.
You know, it also reminds me of what Carol Quigley warned about, that you can either be a republic or an empire, and when you completely embrace empire, you're on the path to self-destruction. Of course, the worse you overdo it, the worse you overdo it, because it's sort of like a childish temper tantrum lashing out. And so, as we saw just the other last week, I guess it was, Leon Panetta said, okay, yeah, we are leaving Iraq, but we're building up in the Pacific, though. And it's just the kind of thing like, you know, Hitler embarrassed me at Munich, and so now I'm going to give a war guarantee to Poland or whatever. Like, no, calm down. You know, they do these ridiculous things. I mean, imagine a war with China means hydrogen bombs going off. It means millions and millions of people dying. You can't have a war with China.
They don't know how to control themselves. They need to expand the military empire, or else, you know, they go home without jobs. And you know what? It's actually interesting. You mentioned war, but I actually have a tendency to think that this is less about the military buildup in China and more about their expansion of their economy. I mean,
well, sure. I mean, that's what the wars in Africa are all about and all that too. But the thing is, if you're bluffing with somebody, like, yeah, I could fight you all the time, they might knock your block off. You know what I mean? This
sure,
is the kind of thing that could cause real trouble. And I'm sorry, dude, we were way over time, and I got to get my next guest on the phone. But I really appreciate everything you write and all your time on the show, as always, John.
All right, thanks.
Thanks very much. John Glazer, everybody, news.antiwar.com and antiwar.com/blog. And we'll be right back after this.